This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Quentin Tarantino's new film, Jackie Brown, is reviving the career of Pam Grier. In the 70s, she was the queen of black action films. In Jackie Brown, she plays a middle-aged flight attendant who smuggles money for a gun dealer. After she's busted by ATF agents, she sets up a scam to get herself free of the agents and the gun dealer. Here she is holding a gun on the gun dealer, played by Samuel Jackson, who she suspects is considering knocking her off so she can't betray him.
The way I see it, you and me got one motherfucking thing to talk about. One thing. And that's what you are willing to do for me.
I can get you a lawyer.
Let's be realistic. Now, sooner or later, they're going to get around to offering me a plea deal. And you know that. That's why you came here to kill me.
I ain't come over here to kill you.
Hey, it's okay. Now, I forgive you. Now, let's say, if I tell on you, I walk. If I don't, I go to jail.
Uh-huh.
I want $100,000 in an escrow account in my name if I'm convicted up to a year or put on probation. Now, if I have to do more than a year, you pay another $100,000.
I can do that. But you know I got that problem, and all my money is
in Mexico. Well, I've been thinking about that, too. And I got me an idea.
Well, let me hear that. If we friends again, would you point that motherfucking gun somewhere else?
Back in the 70s, Pam Grier usually played a sexy, tough-talking, two-fisted, sharpshooting Avenger, doing battle with pushers and pimps. Grier was an action hero years before women action heroes were common in mainstream films.
She's bad, she's beautiful, and she's back. She's Pam Grier, and when a woman's this hot, you can never get enough.
How about that?
Next is Coffee, a young nurse who's seen her 11-year-old sister destroyed by drugs. Now she wants to find out who's responsible and pay them all back. She turns into a one-woman hit squad on a trail of vengeance lined with hitmen, prostitutes, and thugs. It's Pam Grier in an explosive story of action, danger, and retribution.
All your friends are dead. Why kill them all?
Coffee.
I spoke with Pam Grier in 1990. She told me who she modeled the women in her films on.
For me, the films that I did, Coffee, Foxy Brown, and Sheba, were based on the women, the female characters in my family, who weren't very physical, but yet they were very strong women, but yet trying to maintain a sense of femininity. And my characters were based on my aunt, my mom, my grandmother, and some of the other women that lived in the neighborhood, that if, you know, they would protect their children with, you know, physical violence if they had to. And I guess for any woman, I think any woman would, whether she's strong or not.
Of course, they didn't go around shooting men in the groin.
No, but I bet you they would if someone tried to attack them. I know where their knee would go if someone would try to steal their purse or hurt one of their children. I know exactly where their knee would go, or a broom or a brick or a skillet.
I think your first film was Black Mama, White Mama. Describe the part you played in that.
Well, it was a takeoff of a film that was done with Sidney Poitier and Tony Curtis, Terry, called The Defiant Ones, right? And, what was it? Yeah,
The Defiant Ones.
The Defiant Ones.
Where they're handcuffed together,
right.
They're both prisoners?
Right, so all of a sudden they did a female version of us escaping from a prison, defiantly trying to survive. So I guess, and it had a different title, Chains of Hate, right? Chains of Hate. And they changed it to Black Mama, White Mama. You know, I'm sure that was to pull in the box office. And it was about two women escape from prison, chained together, and how they help each other. And my co-star, Margaret Markoff, was a ballerina.
Now, there became in your movies, I think, scenes you almost had to do in the films. I think it must have gotten to the point where you almost had to have a scene where you had a long, drawn-out series of fistfights with other women.
Yeah, I think that was some subtle, I don't know what you would call it on the air. I'm trying to find a better word for it. I don't know if it was on the part of the filmmaker or that they really like to see women be physical or do physical things or fight each other. I remember that there were a lot of movies in the 50s where people really were excited to see women, you know, roll around the floor and fight. And I used to see it in my neighborhood, and I didn't like it. It used to bother me, you know, and it still bothers me. It's amazing because I have this strange contradiction. I have an aversion to violence, and I often look like Mary Poppins, the way I dress, and I have that mentality, and then I'll do a film, and it's the antithesis of how I really feel. I think the way I do a film, I see it, and it's something that my mother and my grandparents used to say to me, before you cast stones, walk a mile in someone's shoes. So I think the roles that I play are I try to play someone who has that rage and violence and try to do it well. And I don't think it's something that I just want to do in my career from film after film or that I had to do. I think I was the only one that was really good at it and made it look convincing.
Let me get back to some of your films from the 70s. We were talking about how there was a fight with women in several of the films. Mm. There was also castration scenes where you'd shoot somebody or have another way.
Must have been a metaphor.
How did these end up being an almost trademark in your film?
Well, I think it wasn't to be taken seriously. The many of the scenes in the films weren't to be taken seriously. The castration was for people to I think it was like a modern monster movie where you would see something so horrific and people would like, yeah, get them. That's what the bad guy deserves. He was such a bad guy. And people who have different imaginations will see different things from it. And I think the only castration scene possibly was in this movie, Foxy Brown had one. And it was basically tongue-in-cheek and a bunch of metaphors. I never took it seriously.
Another thing is that in so many of your scenes, your clothes were draped in such a way and you were positioned in such a way as to be the sexiest. So tell me what it was like when they would be positioning you so that you'd be showing off, you know, more cleavage or whatever.
You can't really hide my cleavage. It's just there, unfortunately. I was one of those well-endowed children. And I think, all of that was exploited to sell tickets on behalf of the filmmakers.
Did that bother you, or did you just get into it because you knew that there was a certain camp value in this
No,
also?
It was camp, but it was also an age where nudity in the 70s, we were still riding that wave of, you know, that free love and romping around Woodstock naked and our bodies are beautiful and why should I be ashamed of my body and that. And black women were never appreciated as that woman on the podium. She wasn't in advertising as much. She wasn't considered as beautiful. And black men didn't have these black female sexy images to also feel good about their manhood. And I think that was an accumulation of why, you know, I draped and I was sultry and smoky and all those adjectives that they describe me as.
Pam Grier, recorded in 1990. She's starring in Quentin Tarantino's new film, Jackie Brown. The film is adapted from a crime novel by Elmore Leonard. We'll hear from Elmore Leonard after a break. This is Fresh Air. The new film Jackie Brown is based on the Elmore Leonard novel Rum Punch. The novel has just been republished, but with the new title Jackie Brown. Quentin Tarantino is a big Elmore Leonard fan and has optioned several of his crime novels. Tarantino convinced John Travolta to star in the 1995 adaptation of Leonard's novel Get Shorty. Elmore Leonard is one of America's most popular and critically acclaimed crime writers. His novels include 52 Pickup, Freaky Deaky, Kill Shot, Stick, and Glitz. His new novel, Cuba Libre, will be out in a couple of weeks. One of the things Leonard shares with Tarantino is an ear for dialogue. In 1995, I asked Elmore Leonard about why he emphasizes dialogue in his novels.
I like dialogue. I've always liked dialogue from the very beginning. When I started 44 years ago, I was influenced by writers who were very strong in dialogue. Hemingway, John O'Hara, Steinbeck, a writer not many people know about, Richard Bissell in the 50s. Pajama Game was made from one of his books, 7.5 Cents. I like dialogue. I like to see that white space on the page. The in the exchanges of dialogue rather than those big, heavy, heavy paragraphs full of words. Because I remember being feeling intimidated back in the, say, in the 40s when I first started to read popular novels, Book of the Month Club books. I would think, God, there are too many words in this book. And I still think there are too many words in most books. But dialogue appeals to me. If I can set a scene, and this is what I do, I write in scenes, and I always write from a character's point of view so that the scene takes on the character's sound, at least to some extent. The sound even goes into the narrative.
When you started writing crime fiction, were there places that you would hang out just to listen?
I would hang out in Detroit, Frank Murphy Hall of Justice, which is the criminal courts, and watch examinations, little trials, rather than the, these are the pretrial exams to find out whether a crime has been committed or not. And then finally, by 1979-80, I was spending time with the Detroit police. And I would, I did a piece for the Detroit News on homicide section. That was the first and only piece of journalism I've ever done. And it's the kind of, it was the kind of piece that maybe you'd spend 3 days with the homicide cops and then spend it, take a day to write it, and that was it. But I was with them at least 3 weeks before I even wrote a word and got to know them, and they trusted me, and they showed me their case files. I could just sit there in the squad room and listen to them.
What would you say struck you as being most different about the way cops talked from the way your friends or colleagues talked?
Well, the way cops talk, they're not as educated for the most part. They remind me of professional soldiers, professional non-coms, a guy who's been a sergeant in the Army for 20 years or so. But I respected them. They really wanted to close cases. I saw that nobody was dragging his foot. They were all working hard, and they liked what they were doing. And that inspired me.
Do you think you would have made a good criminal? Let's face it, in a lot of ways you have the mind. You know, you say most of your stuff isn't from research. You just, you know, sit at your typewriter and think it up.
Well, I can think of that, but I wouldn't have the nerve.
Mm-hmm. Are you a confident guy? I mean, you know.
I'm confident about my work. My work. Yeah,
right.
But that took about 15 years, you know, to gain confidence in what you do. I couldn't imagine walking into a bank and saying, give me what money you have on top of that little alarm system that the last bill is lying on, and don't give me any dye pack, and don't give me any funny money or monies with the serial numbers, listed. If you know enough about it, I think you can get away with it. I think bank robbery would be pretty easily, even though 9 out of 10 bank robbers are caught. And I think mostly because they tell other people what they do, and because they're not really professional about it. They need money for drugs.
Now, a lot of your guys are talkers, and they could talk their way.
They have to be talkers.
Yeah, right. They talk their way into things and out of things. And can you do that?
No.
So you couldn't do in real life what your characters do, verbally?
Oh, no, never. No. See, the beauty of it in a scene where you end the scene with a line, with the perfect line, you know? But you write in a book, and you have months to think about it.
Right. Now, do you, like, 5 minutes or 2 days after the moment has passed, think of a good last line you could have said in real life, or do you not think in real life in those terms?
Well, in real life, I'm sitting on a bench at Aspen, 4 o'clock in the afternoon, dead tired. I've come down the mountain. A woman skis down, 25, 30 years younger than I am, puts one boot up on the bench and says, I don't know what's more satisfying, taking off my boots or... And then she used an expression for sleeping with somebody.
And you said...
And I said, like that. and that was probably 15 years ago. And I've been trying to think of... it doesn't even have to be snappy, just something, a decent comeback, you know.
What would you have wanted to communicate to her?
Just something clever. What would Woody Allen say? That would have been enough for me, yeah. I hadn't thought of that before either. I should have put myself in Woody Allen's. And he would have said something a little out, you know.
Well, there might have been a difference between what he said in real life or what he said in a movie.
Well, that's true. I don't think, it wasn't an invitation. She was simply describing how she felt.
Now, I know you were a drinker for many years. When you stopped drinking, did drinking change in your novels?
Yeah. No, the drinking didn't change. I had a little bit more energy then for writing, and I think my books got better. I quit in, when did I quit? 77. It's been 18 years. And I think from the late 70s into the 80s on that my books have gotten a lot better.
Did your characters drink any more or less when you stopped?
No, they continued to drink. I couldn't stop them. They were still drinking Early Times and Jack Daniels. No.
What is it still like for you to write alcohol scenes when
no problem
you can't drink?
No.
Do you particularly enjoy it or anything?
Because they enjoy it. They enjoy it. I have in the book I'm writing, Karen Sisko, the marshal, and her dad, who's my age, are sitting in the backyard drinking Jack Daniels, sipping it and talking, and they really enjoy it. And I can understand that, but I don't have any desire to drink, thank God, because I know if I did, I would, I'd get drunk again. I'd become a drunk.
You started your fiction career writing Westerns.
Yeah.
Tell us about one of the Western heroes you created.
Western heroes. Did I create any?
Western characters.
Oh, yeah. Hombre. I like that character a lot, which Paul Newman played.
In a movie,
yeah. Yeah, I thought I was very proud of that one. And also I liked Valdez's Coming, which Burt Lancaster did. Valdez's Coming is my favorite Western that I wrote. And at the time, when I read it now, I can see my style beginning to change into what I'm doing now. Really not what I'm doing now, but it began to change.
More dialogue-oriented?
Yeah, a little more dialogue, a little more characters, a little more human. I'm loosening up a little bit. And that's what I finally learned, because I had studied Hemingway so closely and learned a lot, but I didn't agree with his attitude about life, about himself. He took everything himself, everything so seriously. But your style comes out of your attitude, what kind of a person you are, you know, your personality, how you see things. Are you optimistic? Are you funny? Are you grim? What? This is all out of your attitude. And once I learned that, then I had to find other writers to study and imitate.
Well, how would you compare your attitude to Hemingway's?
Well, I don't see that much. There is that much to take seriously in everyday situations that come up that people worry about, or people worry about things that might happen, you know, which is a big waste of time. I don't worry.
You don't worry?
I don't worry.
So this is one of the differences between you and Hemingway. You don't worry about things.
No.
You don't brood about things.
We know how seriously he took himself, right, with that shotgun he put in his mouth.
Right.
No, I don't see any reason to do that.
Right.
I don't take my work that seriously, and I think that's what keeps me loose. If I try to write, if I catch myself trying to write, I'll fall right on my face. I'll see it. If I see in the prose that I'm boy, look at me writing, I rewrite it. I rewrite it because I think it's distracting.
Elmore Leonard recorded in 1995. His novel Rum Punch was adapted into the new film Jackie Brown. Leonard's new novel, Cuba Libre, will be published later this month. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.